Master Richard, you have young eyes. Read me, I pray, this libel."
Dick Shelton took the paper in his hand and read it aloud. It contained some lines of a very rugged doggerel, hardly every rhyming, written in a gross character and most uncouthly spelt. With the spelling somewhat bettered, this is how they ran. "I had four black arrows under my belt, four for the griefs that I have felt, four for the number of ill men that have oppressed me now and then. One is gone, one is well sped, old Appleyard is dead. One is for Master Bennet Hatch, that burned grimstone, walls and thatch. One for Sir Oliver Oates, that cut Sir Harry Shelton's throat. Sir Daniel, ye shall have the fort. We shall think it fair sport. Ye shall each have your own part, a black arrow in each black heart. Get ye to your knees for to pray. Ye are dead thieves by yea and nay. John Amend All of the Green Wood and his Jolly Fellowship." "Item, we have more arrows and good hempen cord for others of your following."
"Now well a day for charity and the Christian graces," cried Sir Oliver lamentably. "Sirs, this is an ill world, and groweth daily worse. I will swear upon the cross of Holywood, I am as innocent of that good knight's hurt, whether in act or purpose, as the babe unchristened. Neither was his throat cut, for therein they are again in error, as there still live credible witnesses to show."
"It boots not, Sir Parson," said Bennet. "Here is unseasonable talk."
"Nay, Master Bennet, not so. Keep ye in your due place, good Bennet," answered the priest. "I shall make my innocence appear. I will upon no consideration lose my poor life in error. I take all men to witness that I am clear of this matter. I was not even in the moat house. I was sent of an errand before 9 upon the clock.
"Sir Oliver," said Hatch, interrupting, "since it please you not to stop this sermon, I will take other means. Gough, sound to horse."
And while the tucket was sounding, Bennet moved close to the bewildered parson and whispered violently in his ear. Dick Shelton saw the priest's eye turned upon him for an instant in a startled glance. He had some cause for thought, for this Sir Harry Shelton was his own natural father. But he said never a word and kept his countenance unmoved. Hatch and Sir Oliver discussed together for a while their altered situation. 10 men, it was decided, between them should be reserved, not only to garrison the moat house, but to escort the priest across the wood. In the meantime, as Bennet was to remain behind, the command of the reinforcement was given to Master Shelton. Indeed, there was no choice. The men were loutish fellows, dull and unskilled in war, while Dick was not only popular, but resolute and grave beyond his age. Although his youth had been spent in these rough country places, the lad had been well taught in letters by Sir Oliver, and Hatch himself had shown him the management of arms and the first principles of command. Bennet had always been kind and helpful. He was one of those who are cruel as the grave to those they call their enemies, but ruggedly faithful and well-willing to their friends. And now, while Sir Oliver entered the next house to write, in his swift, exquisite penmanship, a memorandum of the last occurrences to his master, Sir Daniel Brackley, Bennet came up to his pupil to wish him godspeed upon his enterprise.
"You must go the long way about, Master Shelton," he said, "round by the bridge, for your life. Keep a sure man 50 paces afore you to draw shots, and go softly till you pass the wood. If the rogues fall upon you, ride for it. You will do naught by standing. And keep ever forward, Master Shelton. Turn me not back again, and you love your life. There is no help in Tunstall, mind you that. And now, since you go to the great wars about the king, and I continue to dwell here in extreme jeopardy of my life, and the saints alone can certify if we shall meet again below, I give you my last counsels now at your riding. Keep an eye on Sir Daniel. He is unsure. Put not your trust in the Jack Priest. He intendeth not amiss, but doth the will of others. It is a handgun for Sir Daniel. Get your good lordship where you go. Make your strong friends. Look to it. And think ever a paternoster while on Bennett Hatch. There are worse rogues afoot than Bennett. So Godspeed.
And heaven be with you, Bennett, returned Dick. You are a good friend to me, Ward, and so I shall say ever.
And look, your master, added Hatch with a certain embarrassment, if this amendall should get a shaft into me, you might, mayhap, lay out a gold mark, or mayhap a pound, for my poor soul, for it is like to go stiff with me in purgatory.
You shall have your will of it, Bennett, answered Dick.
But what cheer, man, we shall meet again, where you shall have more need of ale than masses.
The saints so grant it, Master Dick, returned the other. But here comes Sir Oliver, and he were as quick with the longbow as with the pen, he would be a brave man-at-arms.
Sir Oliver gave Dick a sealed packet with this superscription. To my right worshipful master, Sir Daniel Brackley, knight, be this delivered in haste. And Dick, putting it in the bosom of his jacket, gave the word and set forth westward up the village. Book One. The Two Lads. Chapter One. At the Sign of the Sun in Keckley. Sir Daniel and his men lay in and about Keckley that night, warmly quartered and well patrolled. But the Knight of Tunstall was one who never rested from money-getting, and even now, when he was on the brink of an adventure which should make or mar him, he was up an hour after midnight to squeeze poor neighbours. He was one who trafficked greatly in disputed inheritances. It was his way to buy out the most unlikely claimant, and then, by the favour he curried with great lords about the king, procure unjust decisions in his favour, or, if that was too roundabout, to seize the disputed manor by force of arms, and rely on his influence and Sir Oliver's cunning in the law to hold what he had snatched. Keckley was one such place. It had come very lately into his clutches. He still met with opposition from the tenants, and it was to overawe discontent that he had led his troops that way. By 2 in the morning, Sir Daniel sat in the inn-room, close by the fireside, for it was cold at that hour among the fens of Keckley. By his elbow stood a pottle of spiced ale. He had taken off his visored headpiece, and sat with his bald head and thin dark visage resting on one hand, wrapped warmly in a sanguine-coloured cloak. At the lower end of the room, about a dozen of his men stood sentry over the door, or lay asleep on benches, and somewhat nearer hand, a young lad, apparently of 12 or 13, was stretched in a mantle on the floor. The host of the Sun stood before the great man.
"Now, mark me, mine host," Sir Daniel said. "Follow but mine orders, and I shall be your good lord ever. I must have good men for head boroughs, and I will have Adam Moore, High Constable. See to it narrowly. If other men be chosen, it shall avail you nothing. Rather, it shall be found to your sore cost. For those that have paid rent to Walsingham, I shall take good measure, you among the rest, mine host."
"Good night," said the host. "I will swear upon the cross of Holywood I did but pay to Walsingham under compulsion. Nay, bully knight, I love not the rogue Walsinghams.
They were as poor as thieves, bully knight. Give me a great lord like you. Nay, ask me among the neighbours. I am stout for Brackley.
It may be, said Sir Daniel dryly. You shall then pay twice.
The innkeeper made a horrid grimace, but this was a piece of bad luck that might readily befall a tenant in these unruly times, and he was perhaps glad to make his peace so easily.
"Bring up yon fellow, Selden!"
cried the knight, and one of his retainers led up a poor, cringing old man, as pale as a candle and all shaking with the fen fever.
"Sirrah," said Sir Daniel, "your name?"
"And please your worship," replied the man, "my name is Gondel, Gondel of Shoreby, at your good worship's pleasure."
"I have heard you ill reported on," returned the knight. "Ye deal in treason, rogue. Ye trudge the country leasing. Ye are heavily suspicioned of the death of severals. How, fellow, are ye so bold, but I will bring you down?"
"Right honourable and my reverend lord," the man cried, "here is some hodgepodge, saving your good presence. I am but a poor private man, and have hurt none."
"The under-sheriff did report of you most vilely," said the knight. "Seize me," saith he, "that Tyndal of Shoreby."
"Condell, my good lord, Condell is my poor name,"
said the unfortunate.
"Condell or Tyndal, it is all one," replied Sir Daniel coolly. "For by my sooth, ye are here, and I do mightily suspect your honesty. If you would save your neck, write me swiftly an obligation for £20."
"For £20, my good lord?" cried Condell. "Here is midsummer madness. My whole estate amounteth not to 70 shillings."
"Condell or Tyndal," returned Sir Daniel, grinning, "I will run my peril of that loss. Write me down 20, and when I have recovered all I may, I will be good lord to you and pardon you the rest."
"Alas, my good lord, it may not be. I have no skill to write," said Condell.
"Well a day," returned the knight, "here, then, is no remedy. Yet I would fain have spared you, Tyndal, had my conscience suffered. Selden, take me this old shrew softly to the nearest elm, and hang me him tenderly by the neck, where I may see him at my riding. Fare ye well, good Master Condell, dear Master Tyndal. Ye are post-haste for paradise. Fare ye then well."
"Nay, my right pleasant lord," replied Condell, forcing an obsequious smile, "and ye be so masterful, as doth right well become you, I will even, with all my poor skill, do your bidding."
"Friend," quoth Sir Daniel, "ye will now write 20. Go to. You're too cunning for a livelihood of 70 shillings." Selden, see him write me this in good form, and have it duly witnessed."
And Sir Daniel, who was a very merry knight, none merrier in England, took a drink of his mulled ale, and lay back smiling. Meanwhile, the boy upon the floor began to stir, and presently sat up and looked about him with a scare.
"Hither," said Sir Daniel,
and as the other rose at his command and came slowly towards him, he leaned back and laughed outright.
"By the rood," he cried, "a sturdy boy!"
The lad flushed crimson with anger and darted a look of hate out of his dark eyes. Now that he was on his legs, it was more difficult to make certain of his age. His face looked somewhat older in expression, but it was as smooth as a young child's, and in bone and body he was unusually slender, and somewhat awkward of gait.
"Ye have called me, Sir Daniel," he said. "Was it to laugh at my poor plight?"
"Nay, now let laugh," said the knight. "Good shrew, let laugh, I pray you, and ye could see yourself. I warrant ye would laugh the first."
"Well," cried the lad, flushing, "ye shall answer this when ye answer for the other. Laugh while yet ye may."
"Nay, now, good cousin," replied Sir Daniel, with some earnestness, "think not that I mock at you, except in mirth, as between kinsfolk and singular friends. I will make you a marriage of 1,000 pounds. Go to, and cherish you exceedingly. I took you, indeed, roughly, as the time demanded, but from henceforth I shall ungrudgingly maintain and cheerfully serve you. You shall be Mrs. Shelton, Lady Shelton, by my troth, for the lad promiseth bravely. Tut! You will not shy for honest laughter. It purgeth melancholy. They are no rogues who laugh, good cousin. Good, mine host, lay me a meal now for my cousin, Master John. Sit you down, sweetheart, and eat." "Nay," said Master John, "I will break no bread. Since ye force me to this sin, I will fast for my soul's interest. But, good mine host, I pray you of courtesy give me a cup of fair water. I shall be much beholden to your courtesy indeed." "You shall have a dispensation. Go to," cried the knight. "Shalt be well shriven, by my faith. Content you then, and eat." But the lad was obstinate, drank a cup of water, and once more wrapping himself closely in his mantle, sat in a far corner, brooding. In an hour or two there rose a stir in the village, of sentries challenging, and the clatter of arms and horses, and then a troop drew up by the inn door, and Richard Shelton, splashed with mud, presented himself upon the threshold. "Save you, Sir Daniel," he said. "How, Dicky Shelton!" cried the knight, and at the mention of Dick's name the other lad looked curiously across. "What maketh Bennet Hatch?" "Please you, Sir Knight, to take cognizance of this packet from Sir Oliver, wherein are all things fully stated," answered Richard, presenting the priest's letter. "And please you, Father, you were best make all speed to Risingham, for on the way hither we encountered one riding furiously with letters, and by his report my Lord Risingham was sore bested and lacked exceedingly your presence." "How say you, sore bested?" returned the knight. "Nay, then we will make speed sitting down, good Richard. As the world goes in this poor realm of England, he that rides softliest rides surest. Delay, they say, begetteth peril, but it is rather this itch of doing that undoes men. Mark it, Dick. But let me see first what cattle ye have brought. Selden, a link here at the door." And Sir Daniel strode forth into the village street, and by the red glow of a torch inspected his new troops. He was an unpopular neighbour and an unpopular master, but as a leader of war he was well beloved by those who rode behind his pennant. His dash, his proved courage, his forethought for the soldiers' comfort, even his rough jibes, were all to the taste of the bold blades in jack and salet. "Nay, by the rood," he cried, "what poor dogs are these? Here be some as crooked as a bow, and some as lean as a spear. Friends, ye shall ride in the front of the battle. I can spare you, friends. Mark me this old villain on the piebald. A 2-year mutton riding on a hog would look more soldierly. Ah, Clipsby, are you there, old rat? You're a man I could lose with a good heart. Ye shall go in front of all, with a bull's eye painted on your jack, to be the better butt for archery. Sirrah, ye shall show me the way." "I will show you any way, Sir Daniel, but the way to change sides," returned Clipsby sturdily. Sir Daniel laughed a guffaw. "Why, well said," he cried. "Hast a shrewd tongue in thy mouth. Go to, I will forgive you for that merry word. Selden, see them fed, both man and brute." The knight re-entered the inn. "Now, friend Dick," he said, "fall to. Here is good ale and bacon. Eat while that I read." Sir Daniel opened the packet, and as he read his brow darkened. When he had done, he sat a little, musing. Then he looked sharply at his ward, "Dick," he said, "you have seen this penny rhyme?" The lad replied in the affirmative. "It bears your father's name," continued the knight, "and our poor shrew of a parson is, by some mad soul, accused of slaying him."
"He did most eagerly deny it," answered Dick.
"He did?" cried the knight very sharply. "Heed him not. He has a loose tongue. He babbles like a jack sparrow. Some day, when I may find the leisure, Dick, I will myself more fully inform you of these matters. There was one Duckworth shrewdly blamed for it, but the times were troubled, and there was no justice to be got."
"It befell at the Moat House?" Dick ventured, with a beating at his heart.
"It befell between the Moat House and Holywood," replied Sir Daniel calmly, but he shot a covert glance, black with suspicion, at Dick's face. "And now," added the knight, "speed you with your meal. You shall return to Tunstall with a line from me."
Dick's face fell sorely.
"Prithee, Sir Daniel," he cried, "send one of the villains. I beseech you, let me to the battle. I can strike a stroke, I promise you."
"I misdoubt it not," replied Sir Daniel, sitting down to write. "But here, Dick, is no honour to be won. I lie in Kettley till I have sure tidings of the war, and then ride to join me with the conqueror. Cry not on cowardice. It is but wisdom, Dick, for this poor realm so tosseth with rebellion, and the king's name and custody so changeth hands, that no man may be certain of the morrow. Tosspot and Shuttlewit run in, but my Lord Good Counsel sits a one side waiting."
With that, Sir Daniel, turning his back to Dick, and quite at the farther end of the long table, began to write his letter with his mouth on one side, for this business of the Black Arrow stuck sorely in his throat. Meanwhile, young Shelton was going on heartily enough with his breakfast, when he felt a touch upon his arm, and a very soft voice whispering in his ear.
"Make not a sign, I do beseech you," said the voice, "but of your charity teach me the straight way to Holywood. Beseech you now, good boy, comfort a poor soul in peril and extreme distress, and set me so far forth upon the way to my repose."
"Take the path by the windmill," answered Dick in the same tone. "It will bring you to Till Ferry. There inquire again."
And without turning his head, he fell again to eating. But with the tail of his eye, he caught a glimpse of the young lad called Master John stealthily creeping from the room. "Why," thought Dick, "he is as young as I. Good boy, doth he call me? And I had known I should have seen the varlet hanged ere I'd told him. Well, if he goes through the fen, I may come up with him and pull his ears." Half an hour later, Sir Daniel gave Dick the letter, and bade him speed to the Moat House. And again, some half an hour after Dick's departure, a messenger came in hot haste from my Lord Risingham.
"Sir Daniel," the messenger said, "you lose great honour, by my sooth. The fight began again this morning ere the dawn, and we have beaten their van and scattered their right wing. Only the main battle standeth fast, and we had your fresh men, we should tilt them all into the river. What, Sir Knight, will ye bid the last? It stands not with your good credit."
"Nay," cried the knight, "I was but now upon the march. Selden, sound me the tucket. Sir, I am with you on the instant. It is not 2 hours since the more part of my command came in, Sir Messenger. What would you have? Sparing is good meat, but yet it killed the charger. Bustle, boys."
By this time the tucket was sounding cheerily in the morning, and from all sides Sir Daniel's men poured into the main street and formed before the inn. They had slept upon their arms, with chargers saddled, and in 10 minutes 50 men-at-arms and archers, cleanly equipped and briskly disciplined, stood ranked and ready. The chief part were in Sir Daniel's livery, murrey and blue, which gave the greater show to their array. The best armed rode first, and away out of sight at the tail of the column came the sorry reinforcement of the night before. Sir Daniel looked with pride along the line.
"Here be the lads to serve you in a pinch," he said. "They are pretty men indeed," replied the messenger, "but it augments my sorrow that ye had not marched the earlier."
"Well," said the knight, "what would ye? The beginning of a feast and the end of a fray, sir messenger." And he mounted into his saddle.
"Why, how now?" he cried. "John? Joanna? Nay, by the sacred rood, where is she? Host, where is that girl?"
"Girl, Sir Daniel?"
cried the landlord.
"Nay, sir, I saw no girl."
"Boy, then, dotard," cried the knight. "Could ye not see it was a wench? She in the murrey-coloured mantle, she that broke her fast with Water Rogue, where is she?"
"Nay, the saints bless us. Master John, ye called him," said the host. "Well, I thought none evil. He's gone. I saw him, her. I saw her in the stable a good hour agone. I was saddling a grey horse."
"Now, by the rood," cried Sir Daniel, "the wench was worth £500 to me, and more."
"Sir Knight," observed the messenger with bitterness, "while that ye are here roaring for £500, the realm of England is elsewhere being lost and won."
"It is well said," replied Sir Daniel. "Selden, form me out with 6 crossbowmen. Hunt me her down. I care not what it cost. But at my returning, let me find her at the moat-house. Be it upon your head. And now, Sir Messenger, we march."
And the troop broke into a good trot, and Selden and his 6 men were left behind upon the street of Ketley with the staring villagers. Chapter 2. In the Fen. It was near 6 in the May morning when Dick began to ride down into the fen upon his homeward way. The sky was all blue, the jolly wind blew loud and steady, the windmill's sails were spinning, and the willows over all the fen rippling and whitening like a field of corn. He had been all night in the saddle, but his heart was good and his body sound, and he rode right merrily. The path went down and down into the marsh, till he lost sight of all the neighbouring landmarks but Ketley Windmill on the knoll behind him, and the extreme top of Tunstall Forest far before. On either hand there were great fields of blowing reeds and willows, pools of water shaking in the wind, and treacherous bogs as green as emerald, to tempt and to betray the traveller. The path lay almost straight through the morass. It was already very ancient. Its foundation had been laid by Roman soldiery. In the lapse of ages, much of it had sunk, and every here and there, for a few hundred yards, it lay submerged below the stagnant waters of the fen. About a mile from Ketley, Dick came to one such break in the plain line of causeway, where the reeds and willows grew dispersedly, like little islands, and confused the eye. The gap, besides, was more than usually long. It was a place where any stranger might come readily to mischief, and Dick bethought him, with something like a pang, of the lad whom he had so imperfectly directed. As for himself, one look backward to where the windmill sails were turning black against the blue of heaven, one look forward to the high ground of Tunstall Forest, and he was sufficiently directed and held straight on, the water washing to his horse's knees, as safe as on a highway. Halfway across, and when he'd already sighted the path rising high and dry upon the farther side, he was aware of a great splashing on his right, and saw a grey horse sunk to its belly in the mud, and still spasmodically struggling. Instantly, as though it had divined the neighbourhood of help, the poor beast began to neigh most piercingly. It rolled, meanwhile, a bloodshot eye, insane with terror, and as it sprawled, wallowing in the quag, clouds of stinging insects rose and buzzed about it in the air.